Species.
Unite.
Species. Unite.
Our cultures are built around stories, right? So we connect through stories, we learn through stories, and stories are often stronger when they have characters. So characters we can connect with. And I think that that's been a struggle for many, many animals, all kinds of animals, that they don't have a face or a character that people can connect with.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Novogratz. This is Species Unite. We have a favor to ask. If you like today's episode and you have a spare minute, could you please rate and review Species Unite on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts? It really helps people to find the show. This conversation is with Dr. Mark Elbrock. Mark is an ecologist, an author, a storyteller, and a scientist for Panthera, the global wildcat conservation organization. Mark's research has challenged everything that we thought we knew about the social lives of mountain lions. He's written many books, including Cougar Conundrum, Sharing the World with a Successful Predator. How are you?
I'm good. Yourself?
Where are you?
I am in Western Washington, about 100 miles west of Seattle.
And is that home?
That is home. Yep.
It must be beautiful.
Yeah, it's nice. Beautiful day, snow on the mountains.
I'm such a good example of somebody you talk about in your book who literally knew, like, I thought I knew about mountain lions. I mean, I didn't think I was like an expert by any means. And then I read your book and realized, like, I don't know anything about mountain lions. Now I do.
Well, right on. I appreciate that.
I actually had an encounter in September in New Mexico, and I was with my sister-in-law. We were, I don't know, maybe 100 feet from a mountain lion, and he or she stared us down and didn't move. I really thought, like, oh my God, she's going to attack us. And it went on for a really long time. I mean, like 5-7 minutes. Felt like an eternity. And it was the end of the day, you know, late afternoon. I was like with my phone out in front of me, Googling, like, what do we do? What do we do? And she wouldn't leave. I really thought this was it. Like, she was just waiting to like attack us. And then two people came. We didn't even know there was anyone else on the mountain. Two people came down behind us. And as soon as you could hear them, boom, she was gone. So I really appreciate you even more because of that.
Yeah, what an encounter.
It was really cool for like the first minute, but it got scary.
Yeah, and they have that weird way of looking at you that kind of makes for an unsettling. I find them hard to read. You know, like you look at a bear and you can pretty much tell what it's thinking. But you look at a lion and it's sort of... it's almost alien, just that cat stinger.
Because I knew so little. I would just love to start with talking about some of the myths. I know a lot about wolves. I just got on this wolf kick last year and I interviewed anybody and everybody I could about wolves. It didn't even occur to me during this to think that mountain lions were going through a similar thing. I thought they were pretty safe. So that's one myth right there that I would love to start with.
Certainly in recent years, there's pretty aggressive movement among the Western states in particular to increase their, we'll call it harvest, you know, their legal killing of mountain lions. What's even more shocking is this sort of movement to unlimited take, which for a rare animal on a landscape is just indefensible. You know, there's no scientific place you can stand and tell me that there is a legitimate reason to kill an unlimited number of some type of animal. And then in the second part of your sentence, say that you're doing conservation or you believe in sustainable populations. I mean, those two don't go together. But yeah, I mean, shocking that Idaho is now unlimited. I have friends in Idaho who say it's tough to find cats now after a couple of years of unlimited take. Other states are considering this. And then you see the harvest quotas, which are, you know, some people are trying to use the word hunting limits now. So it's sort of this idea that's a threshold that protects the species, right? You can kill as many of them up to that limit, but the numbers in some states are so high that they're never reached. And so they don't provide any protection at all. They're just, you know, they're just paper unicorns to kind of placate folks that there's some sort of science or some sort of defensible method or some sort of conservation acting on the behalf of the species, when in fact it's essentially unlimited take. And it's all about fear and politics and craziness, and it's not about the reality of living with these animals.
Talk about the fear a little bit, because one thing I also learned in your book was that more people are killed by cows than mountain lions every year. Right. If I'd known that, I would have been less scared maybe when I was on top of the mountain.
True. It's, you know, I try not to talk about it too much now, because a lot of social science has shown that fear is irrational. You know, it's if it were strictly rational, we could talk about the numbers and everyone say, okay, I have a 0.0002% chance of being attacked by a mountain lion. I'm really not going to worry about it. But it's just, it doesn't work that way, right? You know, people, their imaginations go wild. They see an animal with big teeth, with claws, with the potential to do harm. And of course, we're afraid of them. And some of that is, you know, without doubt, biological, and you know, there's a reason for it. It helps us survive. And part of it is completely irrational. And, you know, as a species, or we'll just say as a population that's becoming more and more disconnected from the way ecology works and natural systems, it's easier for us to fill in the holes in our knowledge with our imagination. And so I think, you know, more and more, at least for an animal like mountain lions, you get folks sort of making stuff up about them rather than relying on what we actually know about them. And so that's one of the things that works against them in terms of fear. But then there's, you know, I think beyond that, there's this deep-rooted cultural sort of belief that these large carnivores are competition with us for what we value. And certainly that there are the potential risks to people, but more importantly, the potential risks to goats and sheep and cows and now deer and elk that we value more than mountain lions in terms of what they provide to society, or, you know, that tiny slice of society that hunts. And so, yeah, I mean, all of that just wrapped up together, and then you just add in the mountains of propaganda and millions of dollars supporting that propaganda machine about carnivores and mountain lions and the need to control them, and, you know, how it's benefiting us and how the best thing we can do for our own safety and livestock safety is to control them and kill them and this and that. It's just a vicious cycle that's, and the momentum of that machine is hard to kind of derail, and so that we could build a new system in which we coexist a bit more with them.
Are there any coexistence programs happening?
Sure, absolutely. And, you know, around the world, there are lots of examples of coexistence programs. I mean, one of the interesting things about, you know, when we do look at the rest of the world, is there are many cultures that part of the way they grow up thinking about wildlife is they're part of their world. And so there's never this expectation that you need to control them, or reduce them, or remove them if they do something, quote, wrong. Like, that's a really foreign idea to many cultures around the world. And Americans, of course, who promote themselves as, you know, some of the leaders of wildlife management and the most progressive, seem to fail to notice that there are other models out there that are, let's say, equally successful, if not more, depending on the goals and objectives. And that these things are a choice. And then the other part of, like, that cultural piece that fascinates me is that, you know, in the United States, you know, we're so driven by our desire to be individuals and to support individualism in our laws, regulations, and even in our cultural sort of norms, right? So for instance, bringing it to mountain lions is, if I have three goats and a mountain lion kills one, the state will remove that goat because I, as an individual, have every right to have three goats. I, as an individual, have every right not to protect them. I have every right to draw on public funds to kill that mountain lion. But there's never a discussion of what does that removal do to the community of people here? Do most of the people on my mountain want to remove that mountain lion? What does that do to ecological resilience in the area, to the health of the ecosystem that is actually supporting a larger body of humans than just me? And other cultures look at the community as a greater priority than the individual. It's just reversed.
I've had quite a few people on lately from India who are mostly working conservation. And every single one of them, their stories about, you know, coexistence, human-animal conflict, are stunning in the sense that, oh, everybody's willing to work that way. Oh, wait, if you're going to bring in coexistence, yeah, of course that's how we want to do it. There's not even an argument. People would much rather have the animals, they respect them, and learn how to live with them better. No one wants to shoot them.
Absolutely. India is a wonderful example of a very, very different cultural model about living with wildlife. And, you know, to bring it back to home, though, there are coexistence programs here. There's lots. You know, there's range rider programs for wolves. There's, you know, that are state subsidized in Washington, for example. Oregon, there's one county. I think they're trying to make it statewide now that has public money in a pot that helps people build defensive infrastructure, which is something I've been trying to promote here in Washington is, you know, think about that. You know, there are people who have three goats or six goats or whatever. And they are the biggest issue for mountain lions. It's a very, mountain lions are not an issue on, you know, huge ranches. It's these, these rural landscapes where people have a couple hobby animals in the backyard. They kill one and then the cat's removed. It's the leading cause of death in our study here by far, like triple anything else. We had a property that over a year removed three cats on her property with no changes on her part. Like she just refused to make any changes and the state just kept killing cats. And I'm like, you know, this needs to stop. And so one way to do that is first through education, but second to provide public funds to say, you know, you can apply for this pot of cash and perhaps even link it to, you know, some working group that could provide volunteer service to actually build a little place for it. You know, we're talking six animals. This is not, you know, going to be a 40 by 60 barn. This is, you know, a 12 by 12 little fence and, you know, with a roof, importantly with a roof, because mountain lions can jump really high. And, you know, you put them in at night and you take them out in the morning and that, boom, problem solved. So that kind of coexistence program, you know, does exist, as I said, in Oregon, and it does exist in that there's subsidies and sort of these working solutions for different kinds of wildlife. There's, I've seen it a lot for elk, where elk are coming in and raiding hay, and they provide support for these ranchers to minimize that conflict. You see it for wolves with range riders in several states. You see these compensation programs where states will have a public pot of money that if a large carnivore kills their livestock, that they'll be compensated generally generously. I would call it generously. Some would argue against that, you know, because they generally you get like a three or five times the market value on that given day that it was killed. But, you know, they do have a point, one rancher pointed out, but you haven't looked at the potential of that animal. It could have young that grow up, they have young that grow up, they have young. So there, you know, it really is more than the day's value. So anyways, there is that give and take, but there are efforts underway to kind of help people live with wildlife.
But more and more wildlife is being killed. So it's not stopping the hatred.
No, absolutely not. It is not stopping the hatred or the misinformation, which I think is more important. You know, to me, when I think of people, you know, there are haters and there are lovers on any topic, mountain lions in particular, and those people aren't going to change. But there's so many people in between those two extremes that are somewhere on the spectrum that could be changed. And those people get influenced by misinformation. And they're the larger portion of society that I think are worth tackling. I mean, the haters are going to be haters. That's who they are. And lovers are going to be lovers. Like, you know, mountain lions could mow down a sheep farm and attack three people, and the lovers are still going to love them because they love them.
Right.
You know, so.
Even after like my incident with the mountain lion, there wasn't a bone in my body that thought, oh, we shouldn't have these. I was in his house.
Right.
There's a lot of people that don't think that way. What about a mountain lion like P-22, who is quite a celebrity in California, or was, recently died. Will you just, for people who don't know, say who he was? Because my question is, does that do anything for their case or their cause, a situation like him?
Absolutely. I mean, I think people are, our cultures are built around stories, right? So we connect through stories, we learn through stories, and stories are often stronger when they have characters. So characters we can connect with. And I think that that's been a struggle for many, many animals, all kinds of animals, that they don't have a face or a character that people can connect with. And, you know, that's why Bambi was such a success, right? It suddenly put a face and a name to the baby deer in the backyard, and suddenly people care about the baby deer. And, you know, that's happened for lots of animals. But P22 was one of the best examples of utilizing a character to connect a community to a cause. And I mean, it was brilliant, and it was strategic, and it worked, and it's ongoing. And so P22, for those who don't know, is a male mountain lion in Southern California. He miraculously, and no one knows exactly how, he made it to Griffith Park, which is below the Hollywood sign, and surrounded by urban sprawl, you know, crossed many, many lanes of traffic to get there. So it's a true miracle. And if you've been to LA, you know that the traffic doesn't stop even in the middle of the night. I mean, it's how he dodged the cars is unknown, but he made it. And so he was discovered, just happenstance that I know the person who did it, because he was a classmate of mine in graduate school. So Miguel Ordena, you know, was setting cameras in Griffith Park and got a picture of a mountain lion, was like, oh my God, what's this doing here? You know, I think his quote back from years ago was like, it was like finding Bigfoot, you know, he wasn't supposed to be there. But there was a mountain lion project nearby. And so in the Santa Monicas, which is just nearby, just north on the north side of LA, this little mountain range, it's isolated because you've got ocean on one side and then Highway 101 on the other. And it just makes this little island of habitat. And it's a national park, so it's protected. And they had been catching and following mountain lions. And so he got in touch with those folks. They went out and they caught him. They caught P22. And I'm trying to remember if this was 2013, maybe somewhere right around there. And he was a young male at the time. And they got a GPS collar on him. And they followed him until he died this past December. And so you had this amazing opportunity, because now that he has a GPS collar, they know where he is. They can tell his story. They know what he's doing. They knew when he broke into the zoo and they thought he ate a koala. They know, I mean, they had all these little anecdotes. And because he has a collar, he was so easy to recognize, because he was being seen on door cams and all sorts of things. And people would see him in the streets or when they're walking their dog, and they knew it was him. But they were also able to, over time, say that he is the only mountain lion here. No other mountain lions exist in this park. It was tiny in relative to what a male mountain lion usually wanders. So he had this tiny, it's as far as I know, the smallest male mountain lion home range ever recorded, because there was nowhere else to go. And he lived a relatively peaceful life for a long time, you know, and essentially a decade. And then, you know, grew old. And if he had been a wild mountain lion, he probably would have died earlier because of competition. And, you know, as they start to lose their physical sort of strength, and other males will challenge them and perhaps displace them. But he lived a pretty decent life as far as we could tell. All of this is story, because they're spreading his story over and over and over again and telling it as it's happening. And then most importantly, I think to link it to some sort of conservation cause, right? So that he not only provided a face for mountain lions, he was LA's mountain lion. And so when they decided to build a bridge to help the Santa Monica mountain lions, of which there are like 12, but other wildlife as well, millions and millions and millions of dollars, LA raised that money. And so they foot the bill for this wildlife bridge. And P22 was the poster child. You know, it was all about sort of increasing connectivity for not really to Griffith Park, but to the Santa Monica's where P-22 originated.
Right.
And so it was amazing. I think there's a lot to be learned there about how to engage people and how to, you know, tell a story about an individual animal and how people just fall in love.
It is super cool. And I mean, aside from the fact that obviously there are these awesome animals and it's their country too, will you talk about like reasons we need mountain lions, that we need them on the planet?
Yeah.
Why they're so important.
Yeah. I mean, there's obviously a lot of reasons why we should have them. Everything from mental to emotional to spiritual to everything, you know, that these are an animal that are wild and remind us that we are not the biggest and baddest thing out in the world at the right time and in an appropriate way, that we are part of an ecosystem in which we should be paying attention to what's around us. I mean, and all that to me is value enough. I mean, there's intrinsic value in mountain lions that shouldn't be understated, but there is now more and more evidence that they are a species that is particularly important to healthy ecosystems, or more important than others. So we know that when they are present, that they are supporting so many other species, and so are very likely increasing biodiversity in local hotspots. We know there's a paper that's going to come out, I think, next week, where we show that even the carcass itself is depositing nitrogen, phosphorus, carbon into the ground, and that this nitrogen is changing the soil chemistry, increasing nitrogen, and it's being uptook by the plants right next to these kills, and it's changing their whole internal chemistry, which could potentially make them more attractive to other ungulate grazers, etc. So it's just, and that they kill in particular places, and so it creates little hot spots of sort of chemical activity, and which increases the diversity across the landscape. So nitrogen is not evenly sprinkled across a landscape. It's like in little pockets, and same thing for carbon, etc. And that these hotspots are important because they drive a different plant community, a different insect community, a different mammal assemblage. And so, as I said, biodiversity is important. You want lots of different variations of the spread of material, and that variation increases biodiversity, supports, you know, sort of all of these health metrics and resilience. So another way that they do it, you know, in terms of prey, is that when they kill an animal, that, you know, they're sort of a unique species because they're often not the top carnivore in the system. They're just below it. And I think, you know, that we're kind of really gathering a story through different research projects that shows that because they grow up with wolves, brown bears, black bears, jaguars, they have this very timid personality. And one of the results in is that they abandon their food quite easily. And all of that food now supports this incredible diversity of animals and, you know, hundreds of species feeding on their kills. So when they kill something, by providing food to all these animals, they create all these additional linkages that weren't there without them. So, I mean, you see direct things like chickadees and mice feeding on deer. You know, the fact that deer are now linked to a chickadee is unusual. You know, people don't usually make that connection. Or that a mouse or a shrew, we just got videos of a shrew just chowing down on this deer here in Washington. And, you know, you just don't make those links in your head typically, but all of those links are moving energy in the system in new ways that increase its ability to move energy to heal itself in the case that there is some sort of emergency or change in the system. So those are kind of cool ways to think of them invisibly supporting health of the ecosystem and spreading nutrients and moving energy. And I think what you're referring to recently is that, you know, we did do a review of how many species they were sort of connected to.
Yeah.
We found that they were directly connected to 485 kinds of plants and animals that are directly linked to mountain lions, which is, you know, amazing. I mean, it's incredible.
485. It's astonishing.
It's astonishing.
Especially when you think of how most people think of mountain lions as these very like solo loner, you know, that they kind of don't really touch anyone or anything and they're just doing their own thing.
No, they're absolutely totally interconnected and often invisible. And so I think underappreciated that they really are out there supporting us by providing us stronger, healthier ecosystems.
And there are people who want them completely gone.
Sure, yeah. But I would hope they're the real minority. You know, I think...
I would too.
I do believe that there's lots of folks who think they need to be controlled, because and it's generally to do with fear, right? So they think that they're...
Yeah.
That by controlling them, that they're safer, their children are safer, their goats are safer, whatever. But I don't meet many people who are like, we should kill every one of them, you know,
okay.
And
good.
And especially not hunters. I mean, you know, ironically,
right.
You know, a lot of hound hunters, et cetera, they certainly don't want to see mountain lions reduced to any number where, you know, that they're suffering that they like mountain lions. They want them around, you know.
In the states now that have no limits, is there a chance of like eradicating them?
I hope not. I mean, you know, the argument is that the state agencies use what's called adaptive management so that they can change quickly. They can say, okay, now there's evidence that there's less of them, and now let's let them bounce back. And we have done that over time. In the 90s, there was sort of where incidents with mountain lions peaked, and it has never been that high since in terms of human encounters, attacks, you know, livestock issues. The states just all across the West just started mowing down mountain lions. And we don't have the numbers, but it looks like they got knocked back pretty hard because all of those metrics went way down again. And then they just started to climb, you know, starting at the end of the 2000s or something like that. And now we're seeing again this like wave of heavy-handed management. So as long as they release that heavy hand at some point, we'll see some recovery, or we will see recovery. I mean, mountain lions are resilient. They're amazingly resilient. It's the one thing that really, you know, allows me some relief is that, you know, that even as heavy-handed as some of these states are being, that they can bounce back. The one component of that that we don't really understand yet is what sort of the lineage of that impact will be in future generations. And we're only just getting to the place where we can look at that. So like when you look at genetics, people talk about genetics a lot these days, but the way we look at it is by looking at tiny pieces of the genome. But now there's full genome research, and that allows you to look at like when a population was knocked back and whether it's recovered since, or whether there's been, and so you can really look at the history of a population. And I think we're going to find in the next, you know, we're going to see in the next 5 or so years work on this species coming out of certain labs, especially one in California, that's looking at that and whether we can actually gain insight into the health of a population and whether it's recovered genetically as well as in terms of numbers after being heavily harvested or heavily handed some sort of persecution. And certainly mountain lions, my goodness, the history in this country is that they were knocked back significantly. They have recovered remarkably, you know, perhaps even to greater numbers in some places than they were in the past, certainly in deserts and places where the habitats changed so much. You know, what are the impacts? We don't know. Of all that sort of historic suppression.
Are there states where, well, obviously California, it's illegal to hunt them, but are there states where it's better to be a mountain lion than other states?
Yeah, sure. But even within California, it really varies. You don't want to be a mountain lion up in Siskiyou, where poaching is really high and, you know, that folks are pretty anti-large predator. But you do want to be one down where there's a 3-strike rule that's being enforced. And, you know, if you kill a sheep, they still give you a chance and require the landowner to make modifications before they would allow the state to intervene and remove that cat. you know, you want to really be a mountain lion that's in a wild enough place where you're just kind of left alone. That would be the ideal.
Well, we were coming down the mountain when we had the encounter, and the couple that came down behind us and scared it away. The guy in the couple was from Colorado, and he was an avalanche rescue guy. And he's like, my whole life, all I've wanted was to see a mountain lion, and he missed it. And people, it's pretty lucky to see a mountain lion. It's still pretty rare, right? Like most people don't run into them.
These animals are professional at hiding. They live in between us and, you know, wander through our backyards, and most folks never even know. You know, we're only getting glimpses nowadays because of all the door cams and trail cameras in people's backyards or on the hill. And so that's increasing our awareness of them. But yeah, if you're looking at the United States, it's just impossible to see them. I mean, especially in thick habitats where I live now, it's like, my goodness, you know, they could be 5 feet from me and still invisible.
You wouldn't know. I didn't realize I was so lucky till after.
And I'm glad you feel lucky.
The work you're doing and the research you're doing and everything you've been doing your entire career, the more people can like learn and understand this and read your book, and the more we get on the mountain lions team and the people want to support this and hopefully the more situations like P22, because you're right. I like in talking to so many wolf people, it's a similar thing. A lot of people tell me there's not actually that many haters. It's just, they have really loud voices and it sounds like it's similar.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
that's true. And I think, you know, the other part of research, which has been fun and I think is important to do, is sort of telling about their secret lives, you know, and with wolves, it was a bit more visible and you can see the family structure. And it was just, you know, everyone knew that that was part of wolf culture, but for mountain lions, it was pretty much invisible. And now with new technology, we're able, you know, meaning motion triggered cameras and GPS collars, so I know where they are, so I know where to put a camera. And we're witnessing them in their dens. We're witnessing them with their kittens. We're realizing how intimate their families are and all of the interactions. And then when you couple that with the idea that females are, you know, they over 80% of their lives are with kittens. So, I mean, you can't call that a solitary animal in the sense of an English definition of it, not the biological definition. And then, you know, to see how, like, how often they share food and how frequently they interact with their neighbors. And that's all coming out of this new technology. And it does paint a really different picture that it's not these solitary robotic killing machines, but they are an animal with a social system that have regular interactions with their neighbors. And that most of these interactions are not to fight or to mate. They are about sharing food. And they are, you know, food is almost like a currency in that we found that they, you know, even exhibit reciprocity on some level. So if one cat shares food with another, that cat is 7 times more likely to share food back in the future. And so that totally changes like what the way they're thinking, because to be able to make decisions based on reciprocity, that means they're intelligent enough to say, I'm going to base my future interactions with this neighbor based on how this one goes. If this goes well, you know, I'm going to reciprocate. And if it doesn't, I'm not. And so there's things happening out there that we are just beginning to become aware of. But I think that that will help change the perception of the species. And that's vital. I do believe these wildlife human systems are meant to be together. You know, we are animals just like mountain lions. And sometimes we seem to forget.
It's true. Thank you, Mark, so much for this, for all the work you do. You've educated me a lot this week, so I really appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure.
To learn more about Mark, to read his books, to learn about Panthera, go to our website, speciesunite.com. We will have links to everything. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Species Unite. If you have a spare moment and can do us a favor, please subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. It really helps people find the show. If you'd like to support Species Unite, we'd greatly appreciate it. Go to our website and click donate. I'd like to thank everyone at Species Unite, including Gary Knudsen, Caitlin Pierce, Amy Jones, Paul Healy, Santina Polkey, Ayana Peoples, and Anna Kalner, who wrote and performed today's music. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day.